The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 8/November 15, 2021. It features the diplomat, John Kerry, who is dressed in very diplomatic attire, a blue suit, white shirt, blue patterned tie. Mr. Kerry, or I should say Secretary Kerry, is looking directly into the lens of the camera, neither smiling nor frowning, but a really straightforward, almost serene visage. He has wavy, silvery gray hair and quite a bit of it. As usual, the cover of Time is bordered in red with a small marginal inner border of white. Time itself, in large block letters, is in white superimposed upon a pale blue background, which also serves as the background for John Kerry's portrait. Beginning today with The Brief World, Studying in Secret Online by Vivienne Walt. On the day the Taliban captured Kabul, Farah was at her university. A young man burst into their classroom, disrupting a financial management class. He said, "They are coming here. Run," says Farah, 24, who asked to be identified by a pseudonym. Shaking with fear, she says, "We just stood and started collecting all our notebooks." In the 2 months since Afghanistan's government collapsed August 15, actually more than 2 months by now, thousands of Afghan girls and women like Farah have been shut out of their high schools and universities, their studies over and futures in flux. Before August, about half the 20,000 or so students at Kabul University, the country's oldest university, were female. Women's education was perhaps the strongest sign of change and hope for the new Afghanistan. Yet despite Taliban assurances during negotiations with the U.S. that all Afghans would have the right to education, the new government has barred them from setting foot on campuses, a situation that shows no sign of ending. Despite pressure from Western governments, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid recently said they would be allowed to resume their studies when there is an environment where female students are protected. That has strong echoes of the Taliban banning girls' education during their rule over Afghanistan between 1996 and 2001. However, a lifeline has emerged for these women: online studies. Hundreds of female students have rushed in recent weeks to register for a remote learning program launched by a California-based nonprofit online university. Entering a new program that begins November 1, geared specifically at women banished from their education by the Taliban. Shai Reshef, founder and president of University of the People, UO People, which offers U.S.-accredited degrees to about 100,000 students worldwide, has offered 1,000 scholarships to Afghan women, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Clinton Foundation, Ford Foundation, and others. Others are attempting to offer opportunities for Afghan women to study abroad. The UN Development Program offers several scholarships in nearby Central Asian countries for example, all funded by the EU. But UO People appears to be the sole organization offering large numbers of full scholarships for Afghan women to earn degrees online without leaving their homes. About 2,000 applied, and Reshef says he's raised funds to meet the demand. With us, they can study at home, he says, and no one needs to know. Time spoke to five women who'd been accepted, all of whom are either in hiding or keeping their studies secret. Nasreen, 21, another Kabul University student, says her new scholarship has rescued her from sinking into despair. Despite the high internet costs in Afghanistan and patchy connectivity and frequent electricity blackouts, she says she's determined to throw herself into studying to keep herself emotionally stable. Ahead of her UO People course, Nasreen has also registered for online English classes offered by King's College London, as well as a six-week psychology course at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Farah, who fled her financial management class the day the Taliban seized Kabul, now plans to get a business degree from UO People. With her husband out of work, she says the couple will struggle to pay higher internet charges. She intends to study at night after putting her daughter to bed. I have to go through with my dream, she says. I was planning for my future. I want to achieve that. From the Brief Nation, Halina Hutchins' death could be a turning point for Hollywood by Andrew R. Chow. Halina's name is spelled H-A-L-Y-N-A. Hutchins, H-U-T-C-H-I-N-S. There's a small inset photo here. It appears to feature three people dressed in black, two of whom are kneeling, in front of a makeshift altar, or perhaps not an altar, perhaps just a commemoration or remembrance table, filled with candles in the glass vigil containers. It appears that there are cards or some type of other placards intermingled, flowers, several bouquets of flowers behind them on the wall, and on an easel are photographs of Ms. Hutchins. The caption for this photo reads, "A candlelight vigil for Halina Hutchins in Burbank, California, October 24. Guns have dominated American movies for decades, with millions of fake rounds of ammunition fired off by John Wayne, Sly Stallone, Keanu Reeves, Linda Hamilton, and many other action stars. But this penchant for on-screen violence has ended in real-life tragedy several times throughout Hollywood history, and did so once again October 21, when cinematographer Halina Hutchins was killed after actor Alec Baldwin discharged a prop firearm while filming the movie Rust in New Mexico. According to police reports, Baldwin was rehearsing a scene in which he aimed a revolver at the camera. He had been told the gun did not contain live rounds. Hutchins, behind the camera, was hit in the chest, while director Joel Souza, and that's S-O-U-Z-A, was hit in the shoulder and treated for injuries at the hospital. Many film workers in Hollywood see this tragedy as a breaking point, not only for the way guns are used on sets, but also for larger safety disputes. Across the board, this industry is filled with red flags, film worker Paul Rodriguez tells Time. Every day there is something where you could die. Although some guns used on movie sets are rubber replicas, many are actual weapons, either empty or loaded with blanks. Some directors or actors prefer the visceral authenticity of a real gun and the way it recoils or ejects a cartridge, Blanks, however, can still be dangerous. The wad that holds the gunpowder, which can be made of plastic, paper, felt, or cotton, can be ejected with such force as to be lethal at close range. In 1984, actor John Eric Hexum accidentally killed himself with a pistol loaded with blanks on the set of Cover Up. When joking around, he held the gun to his temple and pulled the trigger. In 1993, actor Brandon Lee, the son of Bruce Lee, was killed while filming The Crow by a gun that, while supposed to be loaded with blanks, had a bullet lodged in its barrel. When film crews work with real guns on set, there are many established protocols in place to prevent accidents. Property masters obtain guns and make sure they are properly stowed. Armorers handle them and give strict instructions to the cast and crew about their usage. Firing pins are often removed, and bullets are not supposed to be anywhere near a set. The fact that Baldwin was handed a live gun reveals a breakdown in the chain of responsibility, explains Bob Primes, a cinematographer who's worked many times with guns. Somewhere along the line, someone got rushed. The police and other news outlets have reported turmoil on set prior to the shooting. Crew members walked out that morning to protest working conditions and had expressed concerns about the set's firearms protocols in the weeks prior. It is likely that the usage of real guns on Hollywood sets will be dramatically stripped back. October 22, the ABC cop show The Rookie announced it would stop using live guns during shoots and instead rely on post-production special effects. On social media, the directors Paul Feig and Ryan Johnson have endorsed similar measures. And the incident also threatens to upend a fragile agreement between the union, IATSE, International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, and Hollywood media companies, who had just negotiated a new contract to avoid a massive strike. Many IATSE members now say they will vote no on the new deal, citing the pervasiveness of 16-hour days and unsafe working conditions like the ones that seem to have led to Hutchins' death. This is a highly dramatic incident in which a young woman was killed. But you don't hear about all the fender benders and traffic accidents with people that fell asleep behind the wheel, says Stephen Lighthill, president of the American Society of Cinematographers. I think it's time to sit down and say, we're not going to do this anymore. Here's an article from the heading, Time Off Books. Profile, Darcy Little Badger Will Tell You the Story, by Annabelle Guterman. Darcy is D-A-R-C-I-E space little space badger. Darcy Little Badger has been shaped by stories, the stories passed down to her through generations of family members, the stories she devoured as a fantasy-obsessed kid, the stories she now writes in books for young adults, and, of course, the story that gave her her name. She was born Darcy Aaron Ryan. Little Badger coming in the tradition of the Lipan Apache tribe upon graduating from high school. Badger is an important figure in the tribe's origin narrative, which says that at first the earth was empty, and then the creatures of the world below set out to explore it. Pausing on a park bench in Brooklyn, the author describes the significance of her namesake. Badger is the animal person who went up to Earth and was responsible enough to then go back down, she explains, and say, hey, y'all should go see this thing. Exploring the mysteries of the planet, and the beings that may exist beyond our comprehension is what anchors Little Badger's acclaimed young adult fiction. Her books sink into the depths of humanity's darkest realities, gun violence, grief, our destruction of the planet, but also imagine the spirits, ghosts, and animals that could exist alongside us. Her second young adult novel, A Snake Falls to Earth, is a coming-of-age fantasy thriller that flips between the perspective of an asexual teenage Lipan, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, it's spelled L-I-P-A-N, Apache girl, and a cottonmouth snake. The book is to be published November 23 and was long listed for this year's National Book Award for Young People's Literature. And like her debut, Elatso, that's E-L-A-T-S-O-E, which was published to fanfare in 2020, Little Badger's new genre-bending narrative draws on her heritage and the tradition of storytelling that has informed her worldview. For native readers, especially Lipan Apache readers, I do hope that they're able to see more of their culture than they have in the past, says the 34-year-old author. And for non-native readers, I hope that they're able to connect to this character and learn a little bit. The Lipan Apache have long lived on the land that is now Texas. Although Little Badger was raised in several places around the world, moving because of her father's job, she considers Texas to be home. Growing up, she worked her way through the fantasy sections of each local library. When she was in the first grade, she wrote her first book, a 40-page mystery involving a murdered garden and opals in the attic. Her father, who was pursuing a Ph.D. in English at the time, helped her send the manuscript to a publisher. They responded with a kindly rejection letter. Her father had it framed. "He wanted me to see how far I would go someday," she says, adding, "It's good to learn as a writer you're going to deal with rejections." She carried that lesson with her to college at Princeton. After trying 2 years in a row to be accepted into the school's creative writing program and being turned down both times, Little Badger pivoted to another subject that had piqued her interest, earth science. An Introduction to Oceanography course left her wondering about all the parts of the world she never knew existed. On a research trip to Bermuda, Little Badger traveled on a small vessel to the deep ocean. She hopped in the water and swam, floating hundreds of meters above the ocean floor. "It was dark underneath my feet, and I felt myself being pulled in," she says, bright-eyed as she remembers how it felt. Even though that was actually quite scary, it was also thrilling, because I realized I had no idea what was under my feet, and I really wanted to understand more. She went on to earn a Ph.D. in oceanography, then took a job editing earth science papers. In 2017, she started writing her first novel on the side. Little Badger's fascination with the natural world, particularly her study of climate science, has proved pivotal in her fiction. It comes through clearly in A Snake Falls to Earth, part of which is set in an alternate version of near-future Texas, where hurricanes and natural disasters are happening with an alarming and ever-increasing frequency. Any resemblance to the extreme weather that has grown more and more frequent in the real world is entirely deliberate. It is a real concern for young people who have unfortunately inherited this state of the world, Little Badger says. She thinks about young people and the struggles they face. Teens are intelligent, they're emotionally complex, and they're experiencing many things for the first time, she says. She admits writing adolescent characters gets more challenging with age as she gets further and further from that period in her own life. "I am not always up on the current terms," she says, "but I hope my respect for them shines through. Sometimes young aspiring writers will tell Little Badger that they're in too much pain to write. The advice she gives them is not to force it, especially in the wake of everything they have had to deal with over the past few years. But for Little Badger herself, the process of writing A Snake Falls to Earth helped her understand how writing can be a way to cope with trauma. Around the same time she sold El Lazo, in late 2018, Little Badger learned that her father had been diagnosed with terminal mesothelioma. By March 2020, his condition had worsened. Little Badger quit her day job and moved temporarily to Connecticut to help care for him, alongside her mother and her brother. She started writing A Snake Falls to Earth while her father was in and out of ICU. Working on the book, which is full of so many imaginative and fantastical elements, provided her with moments to escape the sadness that consumed her life. Although her father did not read much of her favorite genre while she was growing up, he always encouraged her to explore the stories she wanted to tell. "I wanted to finish it in time for him to read it, but it didn't work out that way," she says. She finished a first draft of the book a few months after her father died, but he was able to see one of the first copies of El Lazo in those final months. It was one of the last times she remembers him smiling. Despite writing A Snake Falls to Earth in a period of deep personal pain, and amid a global pandemic, Little Badger unfolds a narrative that manages to be hopeful, fun, and adventurous. It also takes cues from the Lipan Apache origin story. Protagonist Nina, living in that grim near-future version of Texas, is desperate to translate a story in a language she does not quite understand. One passed down from her great-great-grandmother about animal people that live on Earth. The story will be lost to time if she cannot figure out how to read it, and she is certain the little she understands of it is true, that animal people exist. Her theories are confirmed when she crosses paths with a snake person named Oli. That's O-L-I. Oli is from the reflecting world, a magical land of spirits and monsters, and he's come to Earth on a mission. His best friend is gravely ill, and he needs Nina's help to save him. Nina is relentlessly optimistic despite it all. She never stops searching for answers about her great-great-grandmother's story. There is an underlying message of hope in her determination, her belief that she can preserve something sacred. Little Badger remains optimistic, too. There is this sense of almost fatalism, that the world is going to end, she says. The way I think about it is, maybe, but my responsibility is to fight for the best version of the future that I can. There's a photograph here of a really young-looking woman dressed in either black or dark blue. It's hard to tell. Anyway, everything matches. I'm going to say it's very dark navy blue or midnight blue. And she has a tan face. I can't see her hair because it's bound up in a little turban-like hat, which is kind of a navy and gray plaid. Then she's wearing a turtleneck and matching pants in what I'm still calling navy blue. The jacket she wears is a navy blue and beige or gray figured pattern. Not quite a paisley, but with shapes, geometric aspects of it that look almost paisley. And she's wearing sneakers in a navy blue and gray combination. And she's seated on a really high stairway of concrete steps that lead to a light blue sky with some green foliage in the background on some tall trees. Aaron Baker writes 7 questions. Sylvia Earle is the subject. Sylvia Earle is the, that's E-A-R-L-E, the marine biologist on her new book, How Heavy Fishing Increases Carbon Dioxide and Getting to Know Lobsters as Individuals. Almost sounds like a channeling of Darcy Little Badger's story, but I don't know which came first. Question, you have written several books about the ocean. Why this one, National Geographic Ocean, A Global Odyssey, and why now? Answer, this book is my attempt to sum up what we now know about the ocean and make it accessible in digestible bites. If you've got 10 minutes, you can sit down and learn something with beautiful images. Question, why is the ocean so important? Answer, the ocean is where the action is. 97% of the Earth's water is in the ocean. It is where 95% of the biosphere is. If I were an evil alien wishing to alter the nature of life on Earth, I would change the temperature of the ocean. I would change the chemistry. That is exactly what we're doing. Excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere becomes excess carbon dioxide in the ocean that becomes carbonic acid. The ocean is becoming more acidic. That changes everything. What is the single most important thing we can do for the oceans today? Right now, a disproportionate bite out of the ocean is being taken by a relatively small number of countries doing industrial fishing. We have got to get over this idea that wildlife from the ocean is essential for our food security. What we're now beginning to understand is the high cost of eating fish. What does it take to make a pound of tuna? A lot of halibut or cod. What makes the halibut? Smaller fish. What do they eat? Krill. Krill eat phytoplankton, zooplankton. Over the years, thousands of pounds of phytoplankton make a single pound of tuna. So that tuna is expensive in terms of the carbon it has captured. The more fish we take out of the sea, the more carbon dioxide gets released into the atmosphere. Question. We were all awed by the relationship in the documentary My Octopus Teacher. Have you ever experienced something similar? Answer. I have had the privilege of living underwater on 10 different occasions. It has enabled me to get to know individual moray eels, individual groupers, even individual lobsters. They all have faces. They all have attitudes. They have sensory systems much like our own. And yet we somehow harden ourselves to think they don't feel pain. We pride ourselves on being humane, but it does not translate to the way we treat animals in the sea. Question, we have seen our hottest decade since recording began, rising emissions and major losses of coral reefs. What gives you hope? Answer, yes, half the coral reefs are either gone or in a state of sharp decline. The good news? We still got about half of them left. We can reverse to a very large extent the harm we've imposed because now we know. Knowledge is the superpower of the 21st century. Even the smartest people alive when I was born did not know what 10-year-olds today have available to them. That is truly cause for hope. Question, ocean advocates have set a goal to protect 30% of the ocean by 2030, up from less than 3% today. What will it take to get there? Answer, COVID-19 showed us we can change quickly when our lives are threatened. Climate's no different. Our very existence is on the line. The ocean is the blue heart of the planet. 30% by 2030 is a good start, but I say half, as soon as we can get there. How much of your heart do you want to protect? Question. What do you say to those experiencing climate anxiety? Answer. It would be so easy to say, why bother? The problems are so big, there's nothing I can do. I might as well enjoy myself for the time I've got. But it is only hopeless when you give up. Change happens because of individuals who team up with others or inspire others. And soon you have got 10 or 100 or 1,000, and then you've got a movement. There is a black and white photo here of Sylvia Earle, a youthful-looking woman, wearing what appears to be a knit pantsuit. It's dark on the bottom, but it goes only to above her knees, so I'm not even sure whether it's pants or a skirt. And the jacket, which is a cardigan, buttoned up, is probably multi-toned. Again, this is in black and white, so it really only shows shades of darkness and two different shades of gray. This woman appears to have just about shoulder length, kind of a page boy, kind of swept to one side. She is smiling. Her face is very youthful, and her smile is elegant. And her hands, that are almost clasped in front of her at the waist, belie this youthful aspect. The View, subtitled Nation, subtitled The Rudeness Epidemic, by Belinda Luscombe. The pandemic may have had a lethal effect on American manners. Lawyers are reporting ruder clients. Restaurants are reporting ruder clients. Flight attendants, for whom rude clients are no novelty, are reporting mayhem. Passenger fines have exceeded $1 million this year. Re-entry into society is proving to be a little bumpy. This is the View opener. Some people may have thought that having been prevented from mingling with other humans for a period, folks would greet the return of social activity with hugs, revelry, and fellowship. But in many ways, say psychologists, the long separation has made social interactions more fraught. The combination of a contagious, life-threatening disease and a series of unprecedented, life-altering changes in the rules of human engagement have left people anxious, confused, and, if they do not believe the restrictions were necessary, deeply resentful. We are going through a time where, physiologically, people's threat system is at a heightened level, says Bernard Golden, a psychologist and the author of Overcoming Destructive Anger. This long strain on people's mental health could have been exacerbated by isolation, a loss of resources, the death of loved ones, and reduced social support. During COVID, there's been an increase in anxiety, a reported increase in depression, and an increased demand for mental health services, he adds. Lots of people, in other words, are on their very last nerve. This is true, he adds, whether they believe the virus is an existential threat or not. Half the people fear COVID, says Golden. Half the people fear being controlled. Heightening the anxiety, the current situation is unfamiliar to most people. We did not have time to prepare psychologically, says Christina Bicieri, director of the Center for Social Norms and Behavior Dynamics at the University of Pennsylvania. Then, just as it seemed danger had passed, other limitations arrived. Staff shortages, product shortages, longer delivery times. People think, okay, now we can go shopping and go out, and they find that life is not back to normal, Bicieri says. That's spelled Bicieri. There is an enormous amount of frustration. It is not a coincidence, psychologists say, that much of the incivility occurs toward people in customer service industries. People feel almost entitled to be rude to people who are not in a position of power, says Hans Steiner, emeritus professor of psychiatry at Stanford University, especially when they come at them and remind them that they have to do their piece to get rid of this pandemic. The authority dynamic has been completely upended, and it's always easier to punch down. It was not as if Americans were exactly overlooking their differences before the pandemic. Some researchers point to the increase in crude public discourse, both from political leaders and in online discussion, which encourages outside emotions, as the tremor of tactlessness that presaged the current tsunami. But it goes deeper. Angry interactions are not the only thing on the rise. Crimes are too. We're seeing measurable increases in all kinds of crimes. So that suggests to me that there's something changing, says Jay Van Babel, associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University and co-author of a new book on social harmony, The Power of Us. He suggests the reasons are structural and profound. America has lost its sense of solidarity as a result of the widening gaps between haves and have-nots. The more inequality you get, the less of a sense of cohesion there is across socioeconomic classes. The U.S. is not alone in its reentry rudeness. In their book, Recovering Civility During COVID-19, Matteo Bonatti and Stephen T. Zeck of the Politics Department at Monash University in Melbourne argue people were initially bamboozled because they had to communicate using a new set of rules. At the beginning, people just did not know how to be polite, says Zeck. That's Z-E-C-H. It was hard to communicate a smile, and it became necessary to avoid rather than embrace people. But after a certain point, the rudeness became deliberate. It is meant to call attention to what they see as this kind of unjust policy, says Zeck. In the minds of some of the discourteous, snapping at flight attendants is not rude, it's civil disobedience. If the rash of brashness is not just impatience with a unique situation and actually a harbinger of something much deeper, then unwinding it will be more difficult than merely giving flight attendants more training, although that cannot hurt. Meanwhile, psychologists suggest people calm down, breathe more slowly, lower their voices when encountering difficult social situations, or irate people so as not to make any situation worse. All of anger management, says Golden, involves pausing. The View opener, the risk report, Iran and the U.S. play their weak hands, that's W-E-A-K, over a chasm, by Ian Bremmer. The U.S. and Iran are moving closer to confrontation. In 2015, Iran signed a deal with the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China to limit its nuclear production in exchange for the lifting of sanctions that have crippled the nation's economy. In 2018, former President Donald Trump kept a campaign promise to pull the U.S. out of the agreement, and Iran again ramped up its nuclear activity. President Joe Biden pledged to try to restore the deal, but Iran, reluctant to negotiate from a perceived position of weakness and angry that U.S. presidents can so easily reverse their predecessors, is playing hard to get. Iran's government has said at various times it wants to revive the deal, and the country's president, Ibrahim Raisi, entered office in August with a chance to seal a quick agreement with Washington. He would have had to accept limits on what Iran insists is a peaceful nuclear energy program, but the lifting of sanctions would allow Iran to sell much more of its oil and other exports, helping to rebuild its broken economy. Instead, Iran has ramped up its nuclear program in ways that reduce the breakout time needed for it to build a nuclear weapon, and Raisi has offered little at the negotiating table. Diplomacy is now on hold, and prospects for success are fading. The Biden administration has few options. The chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan has reduced the president's tolerance for risk-taking with Iran. That will invite Republican charges of appeasement. Israel, which speaks of Iran's nuclear program as an existential threat, fears Biden's foreign policy focus on China and his determination to pivot America's security focus toward Asia will leave Israel alone, while America's Gulf allies are more concerned about Iran's proxy wars and cyber threats. The fight over the nuclear program could have spillover implications for both nations and the region. As hopes of reviving the nuclear deal fade, Iran will insist on a more limited agreement. To try to force that result, Iran will accumulate more highly enriched uranium, deploy more advanced centrifuges, and test techniques for turning uranium into metal that can be used to make a bomb. As the Biden administration works with allies to dial up more economic pressure, Iran may again remind the world that it can strike shipping in the Persian Gulf. There's also a risk inside Iran that continued economic misery will provoke anti-government protests. And if Raisi does not believe he should offer the nuclear concessions needed to ease that pain, he may instead create distractions in the various Middle East conflicts in which Iran is directly or indirectly involved, particularly in Iraq and Yemen. Fear of U.S.-Israeli strikes inside Iran that his government cannot effectively respond to will prevent Raisi from crossing the ultimate red line by building a bomb, nor is Iran likely to repeat its bold 2019 attack on Saudi oil infrastructure, at least for now. But Iran's hardline president has many options short of that, which could again raise security alerts and add upward pressure on already high and rising oil prices. There's also a continuing risk Israel will decide it must take military action to stop Iran, with or without a nod from Washington. More likely is the less drastic but still dangerous step of Israeli sabotage of Iranian nuclear and military sites, which will provoke Iranian retaliation, including in cyberspace. Miscalculation on either side could provoke a spiraling conflict. The new presidents of the U.S. and Iran are both playing weak hands, and that's making it unexpectedly hard to restore a deal that offers big benefits for both sides. On the same page as the risk report, there's a column entitled Culture, the LGBTQ plus history of the Harlem Renaissance. When Passing, P-A-S-S-I-N-G, debuts on Netflix November 10, the film starring Tessa Thompson and Oscar nominee Ruth N-E-G-G-A, Nega, Neja, I'm sorry, I don't know, will draw new attention to Nella Larsen's 1929 novel. Questions about the relationship between the two female protagonists in this novel have made it not only a milestone work of the Harlem Renaissance, but also a milestone in LGBTQ plus history. Scholars of the 1920s and 30s point out that acknowledging the queer culture and nightlife of the Harlem Renaissance is essential in order to paint a full picture of the time, and also to show there was a thriving LGBTQ plus scene in New York City that long predated the 1969 Stonewall Uprising. The Prohibition era paved the way for LGBTQ plus nightlife and drag balls, but the Harlem Renaissance ended when its patronage died up during the Depression. Writing that depicted gay Harlem went out of print as well. Over the past 30 years, there have been more scholars looking to fill in the gaps of LGBTQ plus history and culture. This was written by Olivia B. Waxman, and there's a really small photograph of an individual wearing what appears to be a white satin tuxedo. That's actually white tie and tails, including the white tie, including a white satiny-looking top hat. The individual is carrying in their right hand, which is gloved. We see only one hand. The picture is of the person in profile. But it looks like a metallic-topped cane, such as someone like Fred Astaire might have used in a dance number in film. But the individual wearing this attire is smiling at the camera. Fair, tan-skinned, dark-eyed, dark and glossily lip-rouged. It is lesbian blues singer Gladys Bentley in New York in 1930. Under the heading The View, Remembrance, What I Learned from Colin Powell by Mark Benioff. A photo here, almost all in blues except for one individual seated on a blue bench but dressed in camouflage with a label above his left breast pockets that says U.S. Army. This person is studying a sheaf of papers, and it's Powell, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff off the coast of Somalia in 1993. Now, I do not know what the interior of either a military helicopter or aircraft looks like in the seating area, so I'm only guessing that that is where this photograph was taken, and to the text. In many ways, we came from completely different worlds. Colin Powell was born in Harlem, raised in the South Bronx, and as a young ROTC cadet in the late 1950s, endured the injustice of the segregated South. I was born in San Francisco, grew up in the 1970s amid the Summer of Love and marches for women's rights, where neighbors proudly flew rainbow flags. He rose to the ranks of the military in Washington with a deep respect for institutions, hierarchy, and tradition. I first made my mark building adventure games for the Atari 800, and later by starting my own software company in an industry that celebrates innovation and breaking old models with new transformative technologies. But when our paths unexpectedly crossed in 1997, Colin Powell helped change the way I see business and the role of companies in the world. I was in Philadelphia for the President's Summit for America's Future, chaired by Powell and his nonprofit, America's Promise, dedicated to lifting up at-risk youth. I was a 32-year-old Silicon Valley techie looking for inspiration, and I have never forgotten what the former general said when he took the stage. This is a time for each and every one of us to look into our own heart, to look into our own community, find someone who's in need, find someone who's wanting, find someone who's looking up to us, and for each and every one of us to reach down, to reach back, to reach across, to lift up a fellow American and put him on the road to success in this wonderful country of ours. Powell told us that day business could do more than simply make money. We had to be a force for good and a platform for change. It was the best advice I had ever heard, and in the years that followed, he became one of the most important mentors in my life. In 2014, I invited General Powell to join Salesforce's board of directors. I wanted our company to benefit from his wisdom, his expertise, and the core values that guided his extraordinary life. He served on our board for 7 years. With his military discipline, he never missed a call. I came to appreciate the qualities that presidents of both parties clearly valued in him: his integrity, his honesty, his pragmatism, and his focus on problem solving. He called me Mark, but I always called him Sir. General Powell knew that at this moment in history, when there's so much public mistrust in institutions, leaders need to make trust one of their highest values. He was the first to admit he was not perfect. He acknowledged mistakes, held himself accountable, and demanded the same of others. He spoke out courageously when he felt our nation or its leaders were falling short of our ideals. General Powell knew that to build trust, companies need a purpose beyond profit. He knew business could not sit on the sidelines in the March for Equality. As a board member, he often joined our all-hands conference calls with many of our 75,000 employees. On one call, after the brutal murder of George Floyd, he recalled being a young soldier fighting in Vietnam, while his wife, Alma, back home in Birmingham, Alabama, guarded their house at night from racist mobs led by Police Chief Bull Connor. "We've come a long way," he told us, "but we've got a very long, long way to go yet." Today, many CEOs struggle with how to have a purpose beyond profit. Many Americans feel we are hopelessly divided as a country. Yes, these are difficult days, but I share Colin Powell's perpetual optimism, because if we need a lodestar for how to live and work and serve others, we could ask for no greater example than the trailblazer from the South Bronx, who taught us to embrace our duty to one another as neighbors, as Americans, and as fellow human beings. The article was written by Mark, M-A-R-C, Benioff, B-E-N-I-O-F-F, who's co-owner of Time and chair and CEO of Salesforce. Time Off Television is the page heading, and the review is Emily in Amherst, written by Judy Berman. Apple TV Plus entered the streaming race in 2019 with a small but splashy stable of originals. The Morning Show had Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon. For All Mankind paired Battlestar Galactica's creator with an alternate history of the space race. CSEE spent millions per episode on Jason Momoa tromping through forests. And then there was Dickinson, an odd, anachronistic period piece from first-time creator Elena Smith that cast Haley Steinfeld as a young Emily Dickinson. Surprisingly, Dickinson became the breakout. Smith's bizarre creation caught on because it felt alive and impassioned in its messiness. That momentum persisted and suffuses the show's third, final, and most ambitious season. Rooted in an intelligent, wild, sensuous performance from Steinfeld, Dickinson remixes facts and conjectures about the poet's life into an exuberantly implausible family dramedy. We meet Emily on the precipice of adulthood. She has found the love of her life in her best friend Sue, Ella Hunt, who's destined to wed Emily's brother Austin, Adrian Blake Ensco. To her family's dismay, the rebellious Emily has no intention of marrying. Why would she waste her life keeping house when she could be writing brilliant poetry? Also, she sees things like a horse-drawn carriage whose passenger is death, personified by rapper Wiz Khalifa. As this detail suggests, the show mixes realism and fantasy, 19th century and 21st. Alongside a punchy pop soundtrack, Smith peppers the dialogue with contemporary notions. "I just don't know why this had to happen in our 20s," someone whines about the Civil War. This style can be jarring, but it's no gimmick. It recontextualizes Dickinson and her poetry, scribbling over stiff black and white portraits to reveal a truly colorful character. Following a sharp second season in which Emily grappled with fame, season three finds her pondering her role during wartime. By intertwining her story with that of a black journalist who travels to aid the abolitionist cause, Dickinson leaves us with a timely message. Even in the darkest days, words matter. There's a photo here of a parlor setting with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people having tea and crumpets, apparently, but one is seated at a very old-fashioned sewing machine, no electricity involved. And in the corner, facing the backs of the people, is a woman of color. There's only one man in the circle. One woman is dressed as if she's about to go out on a date to a nightclub. The others are dressed in more typical Civil War era fashion. Oh, actually, the only man in the circle is also seated at a sewing machine. The caption, Dickinson has a freshness that belies its 19th century setting. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.